Welcome, everybody. I'm Tony Nash, the CEO of Booktopia. I'm running my podcast series, Plugged and Unplanned. And today, we have a very special guest, an Aussie, but all the way from the USA, or actually from all over the world at the moment, Jeremy Hymans. And he has written, along with his co-author, Henry Timms, the book New Power. I have read not all of it, I have to admit, but I've read a lot of it, and it's inspiring and it's thought-provoking, and I'm excited today to have you here and to see where our conversation goes.
Thanks, Tony. It's great to be here.
So when did you actually start writing your book? How long ago?
So it sort of grew out of an article that we wrote in Harvard Business Review at the end of 2014. At the same time, I gave a TED Talk. And so both of those came out in 2014, and we didn't know what would happen. And it was fascinating because people from all over the world started engaging with the idea, and a really diverse range of people. You know, everyone from political activists to business people to churches to the health sector. And so we didn't really intend to write a book, but we realized after we wrote this piece in Harvard Business Review that there was more to say, and there was interest in us kind of really painting this picture of how the world was changing through the lens of how power is changing and how each of us can kind of think about the way that power can work for us and work for society better. So anyway, that's kind of the backstory. We started writing the book in 2015, so in May of 2015. We sort of took about 2 years. We both have day jobs, so it was a lot of weekends. It was a lot of weeks at a time, really thinking about this stuff, absorbing ourselves in the work. We did a whole bunch of things as we were writing the book to kind of get input from around the world, finished the book last summer in the New York sense.
Mm. So I don't know whether you've ever been asked this question, and it's kind of going off on a tangent, but curiosity got the better of me, I mostly listen to audiobooks rather than read backwards and forwards from home to work. And I thought, gee, I wonder how many people these two guys are going to acknowledge in terms of, you know, like you always wonder, there's two guys that have written the book, not one, which I'm curious to know in a second what sort of battle you go through to write, have a co-author. But I thought, I wonder where, and the name, like, and it wasn't, okay, you did mention Richard Branson, who is quoted quite rightfully on the front of the book in terms of how he feels about what you guys have written. But in terms of like my curiosity, probably because of my ADHD, 182 names were on the acknowledgement.
Wow, you are impressive. having figured that out. I didn't know how many people were acknowledged.
Well, the thing is that, you know, the both of you acknowledged. Yes. So obviously there's a lot of people contributing. Mm. And you wouldn't have, and I didn't even include, God knows how many, and the people at this company or like there was, this was just names of people that you actually were referring. So in terms of their input versus your, you know, versus the outcome,
right?
I mean, the book. Are they there because you really felt that they gave you snippets of content that were really relevant? How did, I mean, because that's an army. We have 190 people working at Booktopia.
Yeah, right.
So it's a whole company.
Right. Well, you know, this is a book about new power. So it's a book about how you can use the power of participation to get stuff done and to achieve your own goals. And so it's not surprising. In fact, it would be worrying if we'd written a book about this kind of new kind of participatory power and we had acknowledged no one and involved no one. So it was actually incredibly important to us as we were writing this book to reach out. So we did this in a variety of ways. One of the ways we did it is everywhere we went in the world as we were writing the book, we got people together for a meal. And we would have a roundtable conversation with them about the ideas that in the book that we were developing, testing those ideas, getting input from those people, and getting their perspectives that really filled out the book in fascinating ways. You know, it surfaced compelling case studies to us. It helped us figure out what people needed from this book. So that was part of why so many people were acknowledged, because we really did engage a lot of people in the process of this. It was really important to us as well that we figured out how everyone from a frontline nurse working in a hospital who feels disempowered, who wants to break through the bureaucracy in that place, who wants to do a better job empowering their patients, could find this relevant, as well as someone who was, you know, the boss of a big company like you. So that was challenging, that the ability to kind of reach both of those audiences. And so that was part of why when we did the work of writing the book, we really engaged at both levels throughout, across a huge variety. I mean, part of the thing was when we sold the book, we sold it in many countries up front. So we knew from the beginning as well, this had to be a very global book. So I was just in Brazil last week, and the context in Brazil, where the book's just being published in Portuguese, totally different to the context here. So we also knew we wanted to write a very global book. And that's why when we were writing the book, we also went to many of the places that the book will be released in domestic editions around the world, to understand what was different about the context in China, what was the difference about the context in Germany, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that was fascinating, and that's part of why the book is, I think, the way it is.
So if you had a day job and you were flying to all these people, these places around the world just for the weekends, to that must have been fairly hectic.
Well, yes, it did have some impact on my ability to do my day job. So I run an organization called Purpose, which, you know, it practices a lot of this new power work. So it builds movements, supports movements around the world, works as a consultancy to organizations who are trying to mobilize people and create these kinds of purpose-driven movements. So, yes, it meant that I had to kind of carve out a bunch of time very intentionally. What we found as writers writing the book, when you've got a really hectic day job, you know, you can't write a book in the 20-minute break between meetings. It just doesn't work. So you need to kind of get flow and get really absorbed. So we would just go away. And often, you know, we both live in New York, and much to our spouses' frustration at times, we felt like if we stayed in New York, it would also be very hard to really think deeply, because the distractions of a place that you live are one thing, the distractions of a place that is New York are at another level altogether. So we would deliberately leave the city, go somewhere else, a place sometimes that would stimulate our thinking in new ways. And that was part of the process of writing the book, and part of the way I think that the book was forged.
I mean, I can definitely understand that the work that you do with Purpose obviously has... this has been, I would imagine, somewhat of a platform, or even like there'd be part of the coaching, of the program management that you implement would, you know, bring all of your knowledge into the work that you do. I can definitely understand that. Has that helped your own business in terms of generating more? Like, are you flat out now in your own business because people have been stimulated and inspired by the book?
Yeah, look, the reaction to the book has been amazing, and it's caused all sorts of interesting, unexpected reverberations. And certainly, given that what Purpose does is movement building, it's not all that we do. The book has a really wide canvas, right? So the book is applicable not just to people who want to build movements, but to people who are trying to get a business going, who are launching a product, who are trying to figure out how to navigate the workplace. Those are things that Purpose doesn't do. So, but for the part that Purpose does do, which is really helping people mobilize people around causes and issues, and helping companies, organizations, foundations do that, of course, there's huge relevance. So it's both expanded the focus that I have and the focus that Henry and I have, bringing this message to organizations that we might never have dealt with before. And of course, within my own business, it's definitely, you know, created a bunch of interest. But it's interesting, the stuff that that draws the interest and the stuff that doesn't. It isn't necessarily, you know, we were very lucky, we've got some great media coverage, but it isn't necessarily the op-ed in the New York Times or the, you know, the appearance on a big TV show that draws the interest. It's often these media folks who have really intense followings around their work that then brings people in, which is not surprising. It's part of the argument we make in New Power, is that the people who can build intensity around their work, even if they have a smaller audience, are actually the people who are getting ahead today.
So without naming any people, forget about all the leaders and the people that are making a change in the world, which no doubt resonates with them in particular because they're trying to really get things done at quite a large scale. Mm. Just in terms of the average person, just you know, who's going to work, raising a family, or you know, studying. How does new power fit in with it? Is it simply like, oh, that's how the world works, so therefore, you know, too bad for you. You're not operating at that level, but at least you know why you're in this position. Mm-hmm. Or can it be taken from that macro down to the micro, and people can have their own personal lives be impacted by knowing what you guys are teaching?
Yeah, well, I think we really did write the book for everyday people. And so I think the book is relevant both to how individuals navigate the world. When we were writing the book, we very much thought we're writing a guide to a new world. And people are finding that new world chaotic, overwhelming, confusing. And the book is really about that. And so it's been really interesting that a lot of the reviews of the book have used language like that. You know, this is a roadmap to the world for everyday people. So what does that mean practically? So I think what it means is there's a set of skills that we call old power that most of us intuitively know because we grew up with it. It's the kind of power that you hoard. The more of it you have, the more powerful you are. You learn that if you own something, know something, control something that no one else does, you know, that's how you get ahead. And you navigate through hierarchies, you figure out who the powerful people are that you need to influence. There's a whole set of skills around that. And what we would argue is that most of us have some familiarity with those skills because we grew up in that kind of old power world. Our argument is there's a new set of skills alongside those old power skills that everybody needs to learn. Younger people, some of them have a very intuitive understanding of these skills, but a lot of people, particularly those of us who grew up in a different context, don't. You can think of it as the difference between a Tetris world and a Minecraft world. So you remember Tetris, the video game, the biggest game of the 20th century. Think about how it worked, right? There's blocks are falling on your head. You've got to sort them out into neat rows. You can't actually win Tetris. You're eventually overwhelmed. You don't have very much agency in that game, but you have to learn to operate within that system, right? And you think about Minecraft. It's also a block-based game, the biggest game now of the 21st century, but it works completely differently. Everything in Minecraft is created from the bottom up by its users. So if you're a kid who's playing Minecraft, what you're learning about how the world works is so different. You're learning that the way you get ahead in the world is you create things. You collaborate with other people on those things. You build things in a context where there are no rules, where systems and institutions have become less important. And you think about how that shifts your values, your expectations, about the world. So this new set of skills is really about learning how to harness the energy of these crowds that are all around us. If you're building a dental practice, you need to figure out how to do that, right? Not just if you're running for office. And those set of skills are not necessarily about knowing the most powerful person. They're about inspiring and rallying people and how you do that. They're about raising money in very small increments from lots of people rather than in very big increments from a few people. They're about how you invest people in what you're doing and really give them a sense that they're part of it. If you're a manager in a business, it's about understanding that in this world, this Minecraft world, if you like, people want to shape the world. So if you're struggling with managing people in your business who are trying to basically go over their briefs and they want to, you know, they don't want to stick to their brief. They want to do a whole bunch of other stuff. They want to, they're interns, but they want to be running divisions. These are things that are happening in workplaces now. That's because of these shifts. And we give people very practical advice about how to navigate that world, how to think differently about it, so that you can be more effective in that context. Whether you're a younger person who's frustrated by a world in which you get an annual performance review at work, but when you're on Facebook or Instagram, you're getting constant feedback, and that dissonance can be very disconcerting for a millennial. Or whether you're a person who is trying to figure out why these guys are demanding constant feedback. You know, when you grow up, you know, you were lucky to get an annual review once a year and you were happy with that. So these are some of the kinds of dynamics that we explore in the book, and we do it at the level of principles, and we tell people stories.
So I'm gonna lead you, because I've obviously read some of the book and I've heard you speak before, but maybe some of the listeners to the podcast haven't. Your example of Tetris versus Minecraft, I'm going to flip that on its head and throw it back to you, because when I was a kid, when we bought Lego, you just bought the blocks and they all came in one big, you know, do whatever you want with it. We made houses, we made cars, we used our imagination.
Yeah, yeah.
Today, when we buy Lego for the kids, they're in set packs and they are licensed and they've been designed by engineers. And so it's complete, actually, you know, the whole idea of back then. But I do know that you have an interesting story around the guys from Lego and what they had to do. And it'd be great for you to share that.
It's funny that you mentioned Lego, right? And you're right, obviously, there's an element to which when we didn't have this ubiquitous technology and connectivity, we did have to use our imagination. I agree with you on that. But also you think about a kid today who, because of that technology, can have a YouTube channel, as many of these kids do, with hundreds of thousands of followers all over the world. And how different that was to when we were growing up, when the best we could do was try to get our, you know, letter published to the local newspaper and probably wouldn't succeed, right? So, but Lego's a great story, because actually, you're right, Lego's a great example of a brand where there's a really strong element of participation. Lego was at this point, a story we tell in the book, in the early 2000s, where it had gotten really big, it was very sprawling, and it had lost touch with its fans. And they came back from the brink and became the most valuable brand in the world by a number of measures, in part by rediscovering new power, rediscovering the ability to cultivate their community. They found this group of people, it's kind of funny, called the Adult Fans of Lego. The acronym was AFOLS. So some of your listeners might be adult fans of Lego. These people were kind of in the closet. They thought it was a bit weird. Lego thought it was a bit weird that there were still adults who played Lego. But it actually, when they started looking at the communities that were happening organically around the world, they found that adults were meeting and doing amazing Lego sets, designing really elaborate things. They had way more purchasing power than the kids, right? And they could create these incredible products. So what they then did is they built the whole company around this. So they created an innovation pipeline. They created platforms where people could submit their own designs for sets, the kind that you describe, often user design now, where they would compete, so people would vote to demonstrate demand for that product and the interest in that. It might be a set of women scientists, as one example, where one woman felt like women were underrepresented in Lego products, and particularly women scientists. You know, some of the sets that were targeted to girls were like pink and very gendered. And so she created this amazing set, which represented famous women scientists. She went, she took it onto this platform they'd created, and she got it to market, you know, and she gets a share of the revenue that Lego generates. And they created a marketing arm around this, and they really lent in to all this organic activity that was happening around the world among those AFOLs. So it's an interesting example of a strategy that a very old organization that had become very bureaucratic and corporate was able to adopt and use to kind of turn around the business.
I think, and that's what makes it a great example of and to stimulate people's thinking, whoever's listening or whoever's read your book or who's in a situation where they're feeling like the options are starting to diminish rather than, hold on a second, how can I pivot? How can I flip 180 degrees and look in the other direction and go, well, what else are our options?
Yes.
And I think that...
that's right.
I think that's really, really important for people to do. So in terms of new power, when did it all start to... Because that's the power, you're implying that's the power of today. Mm-hmm. There is blended power, there's still old power. But when did actually new power start to, was it with the internet and therefore the interconnectedness of all of us? Is that when new power started to emerge?
So yeah, so look, there've always been movements, revolutions, communities, collective commerce, that's not new, right? But when we talk about new power, we're talking about the kind of power that is enabled by this ubiquitous connectivity that we have. So you think about Airbnb as a model, for example. So yes, before the internet, there were brochures or sort of catalogs, and they were published every season where people would put their houses in the catalog and you could swap houses for a period of time. Sure, that has elements in common with the Airbnb model, but it was totally not scalable. So sure, a tiny fraction of people transacted in that way using these very laborious methods. You get Airbnb and suddenly you have enough scale, speed, density of participation that you end up transforming, for better and worse, whole cities, real estate stocks and rental markets and the way people are living in major cities. Totally transformational. Why? Because this ubiquitous connectivity just enables a set of things that are were simply not possible 20 or 30 years ago. But what we argue in the book is that we shouldn't focus on the technology. The interesting thing to understand is how it's changing people's sense of their own power, their own agency. What that means then for the attitudes and norms that they bring to their daily lives. Their dissatisfaction with big institutions. It helps explain why people are so frustrated with government, which is so bad at engaging people in a participatory way, which engages with us like we're subjects, right? Just demands that we comply. And why people are more skeptical now of big businesses and are more inclined to take recommendations from people like them. You know, your company is in part informed by the fact that people recommend books to each other, and you're providing a platform in which people can do that. That's more important than the critic in a lot of contexts now. That wasn't the case, as we know, 20 or 30 years ago. So that's the thing that we really want to understand. But it is absolutely true that we're trying to describe this moment we're in the early 21st century, where there's this explosion of participation enabled by connectivity that spawned these totally new models, that's spawning these new attitudes, and what we do about it, and what it all means.
We've come to the end of episode one. We'll take a break. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.